Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. I'm really excited to share this episode, long time coming, with you today. My guest is Justin Wales. Justin is the head of legal for the Americas at Crypto.com. Before going in-house to Crypto.com, he was a partner at the international law firm Cain L. Gates, where he represented crypto companies in all aspects of their business. He recently released a new book, the Crypto Legal Handbook, which I'll link in the show notes below. It's a must-read guide through the laws of crypto, Web3, and an ever-decentralizing world. And I had an opportunity to read it prior to this conversation, so thank you for that, Justin. Really enjoyed it. It was cool to see the Law of Code podcast mentioned, but I really wanted to talk to Justin about why he wrote the handbook, what's inside, why it's so helpful for anyone working in the industry, as well as his unique background. We'll also share some snippets from the book that I think everyone who's listening to this will really benefit from. So once again, you can order the Legal Crypto Handbook in the show notes below. There'll be a link there. But Justin, welcome to the podcast. It's great to finally have you on.
Thanks, Jacob.
I've been badgering Justin for years to get him on the podcast, for those who are unfamiliar with that backstory there. But let's start with the book. Why did you say now's the time for me to publish the Crypto Legal Handbook, and who should read this?
Yeah, it was a long time coming. Really, it came from, I would get questions posed to me on like LinkedIn or emails from law students or young lawyers who want to break into the industry. And they would say, what can I do to break in? How do I learn more information? And I was finding that I had basically 100 links that I would send them and say, here are things, books you should read and articles you should review and videos and podcasts. And it was just like unhelpful. And then at the same time, I was onboarding folks to work on my team and trying to get people who are like outside counsel up to speed with some concepts. And it was just, there wasn't a place that I could point that was, okay, if you read this, you're going to get like the language for basically what a lot of the lawyers in the industry do. So I started writing this as basically an article of what are the first steps you can take. And then the article just expanded and expanded until it took a year to write and about 250 pages. So that it was basically like a thought of like, if I were just starting, what would I want to know? And this is the place to start.
And that was my sentiment when I read it. I wish this came out a couple years earlier, but even now going through it as a non-American, it's so helpful to see the landscape in America, but you also have really good primers on what makes a crypto lawyer, what people should look for when hiring one. You touch on the history of what a security is and much more, which we'll talk about. But your first regulatory principle that you list in the book is that technology is neutral. And there's been plenty of examples spoken about on this podcast, examples like if a money launderer uses Excel, is Excel suddenly a tool for money laundering? I'd love to hear you expand on your thinking around the idea that technology is neutral, and this is the first regulatory principle.
Yeah, the chapter goes through five regulatory principles that I've developed over my career. And it starts with the premise of this idea of a cyclone of progress, right? And this idea that technology moves so quickly. And the way technology advances is not just through advances in technology, but like the technology impacts the culture, impacts the regulation, like feeds back through technology, back to the technology. And such that when you start with something like the internet, for example, that is, okay, this is interesting. It's a way for us to share data online. I can share recipes. I can maybe send you an email, what have you. And then 25 years later, you and I are having a seamless conversation over the internet. So from its earliest days, the internet was and is still used as a tool for crime, right? Cars are used as a tool for crime, right? Horses were used as a tool for crime. There are lots of things that can be utilized for bad activities. And we want to make sure that we're punishing bad activities. And we want to make sure that we're getting at the behavior. But what we don't want to do is we don't want to say, the internet's used as a tool for crime because people are sending emails back and forth to each other, coming up with bad things that they can do. the easiest thing for us to do at that point is to say, no more emails. Everything has to go through the Postal Service. If we did that, where would we, you can see where like the implications are. And the problem is that we're still so early in all of this. No one mainstream is using DeFi, right? Most people are not even using like Bitcoin. They might have some Bitcoin, but not many people are using it compared to where we are with like the advancement of other technologies. So to say this is an area of small economic import, these aren't so important because of where they are right now, it kind of discounts where everything is going. And I do really believe that the most important development about crypto is not that these are new asset classes that you can invest in, but these are ways that we can independently access these networks. And we don't know how these networks will develop, and we don't know what these networks will eventually do. This is the whole, like, we are going to a Web3, like, right, a world. But we're not there yet. And I don't want to create regulation that stops something before it starts on the premise that, oh, it's not even that great. Like, you can't even watch a video on the internet in 1995 or whatever. So should we stop it? No, because look where how things develop.
Yeah, it's such an interesting dynamic because a lot of the regulation that you see comes post-mortem, right? After something negative happens, okay, what went wrong? And then rules are in place so that activity can't happen again. That happened with short selling in the 1930s, and it happened many times throughout history.
I give a really good example in the book of, we have a section on commodities and the rules around commodities. And basically the way you define a commodity is it's everything, any good or service that you could possibly write a futures contract based on. And that's the only test. And there are only two examples of assets or of items that can't be commodities. It's onions movie box office receipts. So why is it that you can't have an onion future market? It's because there were a group of people who basically manipulated the price of onions and created all this sort of havoc. And I think it was like the 50s. And they created the Onion Futures Act, which said you can't have futures contracts made of onions. Now, to this day, onions are the only thing that cannot be listed as a commodity under the CEA, with the exception of box office receipts, which were added in 2010. It's an example of this. They were reacting to something that happened in the market. They created this rule, and now 50 years later, is the rule really necessary? No, it's just this like esoteric holdover of an old time.
One thing I noticed that's notably absent in that list of items that aren't commodities is a security. And a lot of the discussion is around, is something a commodity or a security? And what I loved about your book was you actually changed the discussion there. Could you explain that?
Sure. I see this happening at like the highest levels of dialogue in our industry, which is they say, take an example, token X cannot be a security because it's a commodity. Or they're Bitcoin. Let's use a neutral example, Bitcoin. The CFTC has allowed futures contracts on Bitcoin. They have said that Bitcoin is a commodity. We all agree it is not a security. So in a lot of people's minds, the thought is, oh, Bitcoin's a commodity, therefore it's not a security. In fact, everything other than onions and movie box office receipts are commodities, including securities. So all securities are commodities. They're just a category of commodity called an exempt commodity that places jurisdiction over its sale with the SEC. And you would think, okay, this is maybe like a bit of a pedantic point, but it changes the way I think we as an industry have to start thinking about and arguing over whether something is or is not a security. It's irrelevant about whether it is a commodity or not, because it almost certainly is. It's actually, is it a security under Howey? So in order for something to be a security, it has to meet the Howey criteria as an investment contract. There are other types, but just the CFTC can say anything is a commodity because it almost certainly is. And that has no impact on the other agency. And one of the things I really tried to do in this book because this was the biggest challenge that I had, or one of the bigger challenges I had when I first started learning about regulations, was just understanding why do we have a commodity regulator, a commodity future regulator, I should say, actually, and a securities regulator. Like, why are there two different agencies overseen by two separate, one seen by the financial services, right, regulators, legislatures, one seen by the agricultural committee legislatures? How did this develop? And what I tried to do was take folks through the history of commodity futures and regulations, and then the history of securities regulations, and see how they developed in parallel. And once I think you understand how the two agencies and the rules, the Commodity Exchange Act on the one hand and the Securities Act on the other, developed parallel to each other, you'll understand why this idea that the CFTC says one thing, it impacts the SEC, just falls to the wayside.
And could you share the history of the terminology of security?
It started off as a security was basically something that secured a debt. So think about like when you're putting down a deposit for an apartment, right? It's a security deposit. It was related to an obligation that somebody had. What has happened over time is that the word security has expanded and expanded to mean any sort of a investment that is reliant on the efforts of another. So even though in investment contract language, we have the efforts of other prong, right? We don't have that prong in every type of security. But if you go through the list of the 17 types of securities in the Securities Act, every one of those has some sort of reliance on another for the potential for profit. And it's what separates investment a security from an investment, right? You can make investments in all sorts of things that are not securities in the same way, like lots of commodities can be ordinary commodities like baseball cards, art, cars. No one would think, oh, that car itself is a security, even though you're buying it as an investment. Now, it could be sold as part of a securities offering, and that's when you get into something like the Howey test. But that separation between investment and securities, or investment and commodities, is a distinction that I find a lot of people sometimes miss. We do not, in the United States, have an investment regulator, right? I think Hester Pierce said that it's the Securities and Exchange Commission, not the Securities and Everything Commission. And I think like this point is sometimes underappreciated. And if you look through the history of securities regulations, and I go through this in the book a bit, it was pretty unregulated until the 1800s, when you started having states, including Kansas, develop blue sky laws. And what was happening was you would have people go out to the West, they would sell shares in gold mines that didn't really exist. And the state were seeing that their residents were getting screwed over. So they would require people who were selling those types of investments to register the investment, to register the salespeople with the state, to prove that the opportunity was not as clear, it was not backed by as little as like the blue sky, the clouds in the blue sky. That's where the name came from. But in those earliest state rules, these were merit-based approaches to regulation. So what the regulators would do is they would look at the regulation and they would say, oh, this doesn't seem like a good opportunity that we would want people in our state to invest in. During the Great Depression, after the crash, when Franklin Roosevelt started advocating for these truth and securities rules, initially there was an idea that should these be merit-based regulations? And that was rejected. So a core principle of the U.S. financial market is that we are able to make good or bad decisions with our own money. And what we want is our regulators to take a disclosure-based approach. Okay, what is the information, truthful information, that a person needs to know to determine whether this is a good use of their money or not? What the SEC was never set up to do, what the Commodity Futures Trading Commission was never set up to do, was to determine whether just the purchase of items or the purchase of any investment, an item for an investment, should be regulated at like a spot interval.
And I think one good example of something that people reading the book might have not realized is that distinction between a commodity and a security, and that one could be both, right? Something can be both a commodity and a security. Were there things that during your research for this almost 250-page book that you read or found that surprised you? Or if you had to pick like something that stood out to you as being particularly interesting that you think the narrative or common discussion today is incorrect on, does anything come to mind?
Yeah, the commodity point, I think, is the one that most surprises folks when I tell them this, just because the idea that something not only could be a commodity and a security, but that every security is a commodity is shocking, right? I think if you're involved in the conversations of the space, it's hard to wrap your head around until you read through the actual text. Actually, the thing that was most surprising to me was when I started talking to people about writing the book and the resources and talking about things like Howey, things like the Reeves test, like these cases that we talk about all the time, and seeing how few lawyers, if you really ask them in earnest, actually read through the actual cases, or they've actually pulled definitions that like are being cited. I think it surprised me how so much of the arguments and the discussions that we have in the industry are obtained by osmosis. Like I see tweets about them, I hear podcasts about them, but then sometimes like things change when you actually put your eyes on the actual primary sources. So I try to do what I can to make sure that everything I say in here, like you can go and you can find the primary source. And sometimes I like ask the reader, stop here, go read this actual case and come back. So those are really the two things that like stood out the most to me in writing this and then my conversations after.
And one thing I want to just touch on with you quickly is about this process of writing the book. What have you learned from the process of writing this handbook? And was that always the goal? Was the goal to always write a handbook? I know you mentioned it was initially thought of as an article, but once you decided that it would be a book, how did you approach this idea of a handbook?
Yeah, it really developed naturally. And if I'm going to be honest, it was like a good idea until I thought that I was an idiot for even undertaking it, because it turned out to be more work than I initially had convinced myself it would be. Because again, initially it was supposed to be like an article putting a bunch of links and other resources that I had collected into context. So when a law student or someone sends me a message saying like, where do I start? I could just send it over. So I envisioned it first being like a 10 or 15 page like Medium post or something, Substack post. But as I started writing it, I thought it's not very helpful to just send people on like a goose chase of like tracking down links. And I want to provide context. And I created an outline of all the things that I thought that if I didn't know anything and I got like dropped in the position I'm in right now, what are the things that I needed to know? And let me provide context for, okay, this is Justin taking you through the process. It's as if I'm onboarding you onto my team and I'm just trying to explain to you over 18 different lessons. Here's what you need to know about like perspective on regulation. Here's what you need to know about Bitcoin. Here's what you need to know about how Ethereum developed. Here's what you need to know about decentralized finance. And then Treasury, CFTC, investment contracts, all that. As I just started expanding on that and expanding on that, I realized, one, this is going to take more time than I initially thought. And two, if I don't do this, I don't know anyone who will. And that's not to say that there are not a lot of lawyers who write a lot of really good work on there. But I do find that a lot of the resources out there tend to be created by committee. And I've been involved in these things before where someone reaches out to you and they say Thomson Reuters or Lexis or whoever is putting together a 2024 book on crypto. And can you do the chapter on securities rules, or can you do the chapter on what have you? And you go, okay. And then I call up my summer associate and I say, I got to do a chapter. Here's an outline. Can you write it? And then I review it. And then it gets put into a book with 40 other chapters written by 150 lawyers and lots of summer associates. And you read through it and there's different writing styles. There's information that is different from chapter 1 to chapter 2. It just doesn't become helpful. And then on top of that, they're charging sometimes $200 or $300. I think, Jacob, you said that your book when you were in law school a few years ago was $300 Canadian, right?
That, like, so that, $100 American, but yes.
No, yeah, but like, to me, it's so unhelpful because these things go out of print, out of date so quickly because the cases move so quickly. So what I try to do is, what's the cheapest that I could sell this to basically cover like the printing costs and folks who are helping with like formatting and title and stuff like that. So it's $30. I figured that was like as cheap as I could make it, that it wasn't seen as just a throwaway book, right? Because if you give something away for free, they place no value in it. But like at $30, I think this is like the cheapest resource out there. And I also try to do two other things. Is one is I try to acknowledge where things are like currently still pending at the time of publication. So for instance, like the Coinbase, the Kraken, the Binance cases, it takes you up to like where they are now, including the recent order in Coinbase, and then gives you a link to the docket and says, here's how you find the docket. The other thing that I tried to do is if you go to the cryptolegalhandbook.com/resources, all of the footnotes will be linked there. So you could just easily click on them and you don't have to go and start typing in long URLs. But also where there is an update, I'm going to list the update right into the website. And then because I've decided to self-publish this, and we can talk about why, which I think is like an interesting aside to the way legal publications are handled, I'm able to upload one every fall and spring semester. So every fall and spring semester, I'm going to upload a new version of it. So if you're getting this for a class, it will be by far the most up-to-date book that's on the market, even if something is published that's like a textbook is published after this.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I'd be curious to know, as someone who's never written a book and doesn't have plans to publish one in the near future, but what's the story there? Why self-publish, and what was your research process like into that?
Every time that I've been published by a law review or have gone through a more traditional article publication process, I've always been disappointed because someone has come in and tried to exert some editorial change on me, or the timeline for it has taken so long that by the time whatever I write is published, there's already something that I wish I had said. So in speaking to some friends who have gone through like the traditional publication process for a textbook, it takes so long from the time you send your manuscript, the time someone actually obtains it. And because it's being done through a publisher, you have to charge so much money for them to make it worth their while. I don't need to make any money off of this, right? Like, this is for the good of the industry, really. And no one's getting rich off of this one. So I can make it affordable. I can also publish these updates whenever I want. And honestly, the best part about it is I don't have to take anyone's editorial suggestions, right? I don't have to have a liaison at Thomson Reuters telling me, oh, you got to get your updates done this week. I don't. Like, I can update this every week. The beauty about like self-publishing, and it's Amazon, is like print on demand. So when someone purchases it, they print it right there. So it's not like there's a warehouse full of these books. I could send in an update every single week for the rest of my life, and whoever buys it that week will get the most up-to-date version. I'm not committing to that, but
even if it's just the print version.
Even if it's a print, like I could on it comes out April 20th. Here's a good example. It comes out April 20th. Let's say the Supreme Court on its own decides to take up Binance, Kraken, and Coinbase. This is impossible, but this is just an example. And decide the issue on April 21st. On April 21st, that night, I can update this book, upload a new manuscript, and whoever buys it on April 22nd will get the new book. And that, to me, is the only way to have a handbook that's continuously up to date for folks.
I did not realize the print one would be updated consistently as well, too. So if someone did want to order a new print version every year, they could do so and continue to get the updated book. That's one thing that amazed me with those legal textbooks, because I participated in those chapter writings before. And it just, as you're writing it, almost it becomes out of date because that minute or that hour or that day, there's a new legal update and you can't, there's nothing you can do at that point.
There's actually like an even worse kind of aspect to it, in my view, which is, because it's never Jacob Robinson's book. It's Crypto and the Law 2024, published by this company. And here's 15 chapters, all by 100 different lawyers. What is the sense of ownership you really have to make sure that you're saying things that are correct and that reflect what you believe? And I really tried to do my best that I think, Pete, for better or worse, this is Justin Wales's perspective on crypto law and what I think that someone should know. I think people could disagree with the resources chosen. Some people could maybe disagree with like the way I present things. But for better or worse, this is one person's view. And I think that's like actually like pretty valuable instead of it being this like weird corporatized textbook that's still going to cost you a couple hundred bucks.
And that's something that always amazed me about law school is when you read the textbooks, they're oftentimes so, not only are they difficult to read, but they're very unhelpful. They can be contradictory in certain sections, but many of them feel like they're written just to be written rather than for people to learn. And that's what I found great about your book. The idea of a handbook to me is something that should happen in every industry. And I do think we'll start to see some imitators around the world of, hey, here's a Canadian crypto legal handbook.
What's funny, Jacob, is two people have reached out. I think there's going to be, I don't know how we're going to do it because I don't want to do an entire Canadian book, but I think what we're going to do is write a chapter on Canada. And then another one, someone reached out about helping me do one on India. So it'd be cool if we could end up having a crypto legal handbook. And this will take you, I think, even in other countries, like a perspective on what the US is doing is probably important. But then to have these supplemental chapters that you can download from the website that says, okay, here's what you need to know about FinTrack and the OSC and CSA in Canada. Here's what you need to know about India. And it like builds on that. Someone wanted to do the crypto legal handbook UK or what have you, like go for it.
What chapter do you anticipate being the one you have to update most often in your book? This will be the second last question for you, but which one do you think will be the biggest headache?
I don't know if it's a headache, but the one on just the Securities and Exchange Commission's enforcement regime, because there are cases that are like pending. And in fact, like when Judge Faya's order last week in the Coinbase matter came out on her order on the motion for judgment on the pleadings, I had to go back into the book and add information there. When Sam Bankman-Fried got sentenced, I had to add a citation there. So that regulator seems to be the most active. That being said, the other chapter that I want to like just briefly touch on is state regulators. And what I do is I go through every state and identify its Money Transmitter Act and any notes about like how that state's activity like has developed. Because there are 50 states, every one of them moving independently, that will probably need to be updated pretty frequently as well. But I thought it was really important to have the state issues identified with some specificity, because what I find in a lot of the textbooks that I see or a lot of the resources is they say, oh, and like the states are like, really, there's a lot of state money transmitter rules that most companies need to obtain, but then they don't provide any detail. And the reason why is because that's actually like really hard information to gather and consolidate and put together. So I thought like, all right, this is actually like a pretty good idea for how to conceptualize the different perspectives of the states.
That's why this book is so helpful for non-Americans as well as Americans, because you might have a client who could be looking to enter in the US and here's all of it, or you might just have a client curious about the US. And now you have this guide. While it might not be up to date that very second, you at least know where the risks sit and what you should be thinking about in that particular area.
Yeah. And even a place like Canada's conceptualization of what is or is not a security is based on Howie. So all of the background on how the US's securities regulations developed, how the investment contract cases developed, these are all directly applicable to whether or not something is or is not a security in Canada. Canada has a separate regulatory regime around dealers of securities, which is like very different than ours. And we'll probably address that in this like supplement that we'll create. But every financial regulatory lawyer I know in Canada is intimately familiar with what the SEC has done since it started regulating securities.
I do want to talk quickly about the intended audience. I don't think this is a book just for lawyers, right? Who would you say could benefit most from reading this book?
Yeah, I think it's anyone who wants a primer on crypto, its history, its technology, and sort of the legal issues that impact it. I think it's probably the most useful to people who are entrepreneurs in the space or they're lawyers in the space just starting out. But even those who are just interested in crypto for the historical or sort of cultural reasons for it and want to see how did we get to the point where we are today. There are so many different areas of law and technology and kind of culture that's touched upon within the broader crypto industry that sometimes it's just hard to say, if I wanted to learn more about tax, if I wanted to learn more about commodities, where do I get those resources? What I try to do here is provide an overabundance of supplemental resources. So if you have any thought that you want to expand upon, even if I can't address in the book, there's a reference here to tell you, okay, this is the podcast, this is the video, this is the article you could read to then take the next step and move into a different direction.
It's aptly named a handbook because when you read through it, there's chapters that cover an exhaustive list of the major areas of law that crypto touches, as well as a background on crypto, things like DeFi. But then at the end of the book, there are these supplemental readings and scattered throughout the book as well, where if you're reading this and you say, okay, I do want to know a little bit more about DeFi, here are three or four of the links that Justin recommends. And I think those are valuable resources for people. Also too, right, this book largely has a focus on the American laws. That said, though, I found it so helpful as a non-American get an understanding of how the US laws look, but then see how the rules intertwine with the technology. So let's just talk quickly about a crypto lawyer. So what makes a crypto lawyer in your eyes? What skills should lawyers develop? And what should clients look for when they're hiring?
I come out with it and make the point that I think that a crypto lawyer needs to like crypto and needs to use it to some degree and be involved in the broader conversations and in some ways advocacy around decentralized technologies. What I have found is that this is when I was at a firm and also as in-house counsel trying to hire outside counsel, is that there are lots of lawyers who I speak to who represent crypto companies at very high levels and they're incredible lawyers and they're brilliant. But some of them are completely disinterested in like what the industry is actually building. And crypto could be changed out for any sort of like insurance product or any sort of financial product, and they wouldn't care. They're not crypto lawyers. They're regulatory attorneys or they're litigators or they're business attorneys, but they're not crypto lawyers. They just represent crypto companies. And I think that's a little different than the perspective that I have and the types of folks who I tend to want to hire for roles in-house or I want to even work with if I can as outside counsel, is I want someone who understands the language of what we're trying to build and understands, if not the technology, the concepts at a pretty sophisticated level. And the reason why is because there is friction between the regulation and the technology. And understanding the technology really well lets you figure out and lets you articulate the non-obvious arguments sometimes. And there are plenty examples that I've had in my career where lawyers who are really wonderful, they're very brilliant, they just missed very obvious arguments that anyone who's a first-year lawyer with a bit of a crypto background would know because they just have no background in it. So the crypto, in my view, comes first. The other thing that I tried to do is to make this a handbook and not a textbook. I find that like a textbook, right, is a resource. Maybe you can go and read a section at a time if you have a question. This is meant to be read from page one on. It all develops on itself. And the types of resources that I tried to find were not law review articles or like really difficult to access resources, but things like podcasts, things like YouTube videos, even like really simple animated primers on DeFi concepts, which I thought if someone never has interacted with an automated market maker before, what's the easiest way to describe the concept? Okay, there's actually like a lot of really good, like super 101 resources online, but you would never see them in a textbook because they're silly, because they're just like animated YouTube videos that some guy made. But for you and me and whoever wants to be in the industry, if you're really starting from scratch, that's exactly what you should be pointed to. And not everything has to be a law review article.
Yep. And one thing I want to touch on quickly is your career, because I think your career is very unique and puts you in a position to write a legal handbook around the crypto industry. You, after a few years of practicing law, you developed a generalist industry-focused practice, one that was focused on crypto. And that goes against common advice that you hear, that I personally heard from law firm partners, which is you don't find an industry to work and you find an area of law, you just get really good at that. And then no matter when the industry goes up or down, you'll have some clients. What did you learn from building an industry-focused practice?
Yeah, it's true. I think that there's an over-focus on hyper-specialization, especially at the larger law firms, where they say, all right, Jacob, you're a swaps lawyer. You're going to learn everything there possibly is to know about swaps, and you'll be a great swaps lawyer. The problem is that crypto is such a broad industry. The technology maneuvers across many different fields. And this is an experience that I've had, is I've gone to someone who's a swaps lawyer, and they gave us advice, but the swaps lawyer didn't know the first thing about options. They didn't know the first thing about these adjacent areas of law. So the idea that I've developed over in my career is that it's better to know a lot about a lot of things than everything about one thing. There's clearly a place for hyper-specialization. Technical lawyers are really useful when put to surgical application, but when you're trying to come up with a legal strategy, or you're trying to build out a team, or you're trying to get, you're trying to become someone who's in a position of to consult on like where a business develops or how to utilize first of its kind technologies, it's good to have a pretty thorough understanding of the areas of law that are implicated, even if you're not an expert on every esoteric aspect of an area of law. So that's like the idea, is that it's better to become a generalist. And often, like when you get into a position like mine and you have a little seniority, or even seniority at a law firm, your clients are not going to understand that you only know one thing. And they're going to expect you to like be able to like comment and discuss things outside of whatever was the first thing they assigned you to when you started your career as a first-year law lawyer, which is usually how this happens, right? And this was certainly the case when I first started. I was doing First Amendment law right out of law school, but luckily I had a very supportive mentor. And as I started to develop a crypto interest, and friends of mine would call me and say, you're a lawyer, you're the only lawyer I know, can you help us? I started basically being the associate on for my own cases on all these other for all these other lawyers at my firm, and over several years, I know quite a bit about corporate law. I know quite a bit about money transmitter rules. I know a bit about securities rules, and you collect all of these different experiences. And the law is experiential. Once you end up having a diverse set of experiences, you can then put those all together and represent a client more fulsome in a more fulsome way. And that translates to being able to represent every client in that industry. And if I wanted to, if the crypto industry failed tomorrow, it's not, oh, Justin, too much about too many things, you can never get a job again because you're not specialized. No, I could get a job in any of those, because I have become, by becoming general, you have become specialized in a way.
And it's also so valuable for clients. When I was in law school, we were asked in a corporate law class what a lawyer's role is for companies when you're advising a corporation. And the answer was risk mitigation, right? It's you're managing risks. And when you do have this broad breadth of experience, you can recognize risk, whereas a specialized lawyer might be completely oblivious to even something like money transmitter laws or AML. Justin, last question for you. In your career, what are some habits that you've cultivated or you find have helped you build a successful career? What are some things you do regularly that you would attribute some success to?
I think the first is just being very interested in the areas you're working in. If you're naturally interested in an area of law or an industry like I am, you tend to try harder and learn more, and you want to be good at it, rather than I have some friends who law is just a job to them. And to me, it's more than that. It's really become a central part of my life is this industry. And that break, you become proud of participating in it and doing something well. I think the other is try to be nice to people who you can't get anything out of. This is to me like probably the biggest factor for a lot of my success is just being open to meeting people and talking to people in the industry. One of the things that's like really funny about this, actually, I think, did you reach out to me for the first time when you were still in law school?
Yeah, I would.
So it's a good example is people reach out to you all the time once you get a little gray in your hair and they need help or they want to meet and they want to meet for coffee or have a Zoom. And a lot of times it's a hassle because you have family and you have friends and you have other things that you want to do. But I really do try to answer all of the questions. I really do try to do as much as I can for people who are coming up in the industry because I think it like it pays dividends in the long run. And I've noticed this when I was in law school, I used to write these like really epic outlines for the classes. And these would have pictures and jokes in them. I would really spend a lot of time. And then about 2 weeks before the final, I would send them and give them away for free. And on the bottom of the page, it would just say painstakingly created by Justin Wales. And this was at a time when I think a lot of people were like, you got to hoard the information to yourself. You were graded on a curve. You don't want people to do well because that means that you have to do even better. And my perspective on it is, no, I'd rather make friends than have an incrementally better grade. And to this day, people message me 10, 12 years later saying, I remember your outlines. And I've gotten work from people, like actual, like paying work, who knew me just because they remembered that I did those outlines. And so it's the same sort of thing with something like this, which is I want to create something that people can use, that people are able to benefit their own career with. Maybe, and I'm happy to basically have a conversation with anyone or have go to law schools and talk to law schools about like what it means to be a part of this career. And I think that's good for me in the long run. I think it's good for the industry. And we're all like most people in crypto are pretty bought in. So what's good for the industry is good for me.
Oh, I'm really excited for everyone to get their hands on it. Anyone listening to a podcast like this would certainly benefit from the book. I'll put the link in the show notes below. That's the Crypto Legal Handbook. I think you're the second author now that we've had on the show besides Laura Shin. So that's good company.
Laura Shin's great. I'll just give a shout out to Laura. I mentioned her a couple times in this book, but important to note about the book is that this is not a one-stop shop where you read this and you're an expert. And I did spend a lot of time trying to curate resources where you can learn more. And to me, I love learning about like the history of things. So Nathaniel Popper wrote a book called Digital Gold that takes you through like, your very earliest histories of Bitcoin, non-technical, just narrative. And Laura Shin's book on the history of Ethereum does the same sort of thing where it takes you from the very beginning concepts of the Ethereum development until post-DAO. And I think those are like such good places to start because if you really understand like the personalities involved and how the industry got to where it is, I think you have a pretty, it really helps you out for whatever reason. It really helps you out when you're starting to think about like the regulations and the personalities of these technologies and how the technologies will be impacted by regulations.
And a perfect example of the importance of understanding history is talking about the idea of a commodity and a security. And in the book, how you break down, right, that evolution, it pays dividends to know the history of anything that you're working in, whether it's for regulatory related work or for your own just general knowledge.
I'll just one other anecdote is I talk about compliance and like a Department of Treasury is like BSA, like Bank Secrecy Act. And the Bank Secrecy Act from when it was first created in 1970 was controversial. It was in the Supreme Court only a few years after it was enacted and before it was really widely applied on questions of does this violate the First Amendment? Does this violate the Fourth Amendment? Does this violate the Fifth Amendment? Always controversial. Inflation has never caused the thresholds set by the Bank Secrecy Act for financial reporting to increase. $10,000 in 1970 is about $80,000 today. Now, if you had a $10,000 threshold in 1970 for financial reporting, and you still have a $10,000 threshold for financial reporting today, it changes your view on the scope of the BSA. Because without that historical knowledge, you would say, the BSA has been around for 50 plus years. It's uncontroversial. Actually, if you understand the history, if you understand how things have changed, it changes your perspective on like the financial surveillance regime that has been created around it. And what I really tried to do is give folks who read this like the first principles of the regulation. So you're not coming into this blind. You're understanding how it developed. And I do think that that helps. I can't articulate exactly why it helps, but it helps even when you're dealing with like incredibly new non-historical questions that you need to answer.
Yeah, just the because context is everything, right? A rule in a vacuum is useless. And when you begin to see it over time evolve, like that always stood out to me as interesting as well, that the thresholds for certain transactions in one area will change when it comes to something like accredited investors, but in another area, it doesn't change. And it's really interesting to see that develop over time. And I think the context there is important. Justin, any other things people should know about the book or what you'd like them to do with it, and any other thoughts you'd like to share?
No, go to thecryptolegalhandbook.com. You can purchase it there. You can see all the resources. So even if you don't want to buy it, you can just basically see what I used to send out to law students who ask, which is a list of links and videos that you can watch if you want to do it on your own. And to the extent anyone's listening is involved in any colleges or law schools teaching digital asset law or crypto classes, please reach out. I'd love to see these distributed in law schools. And I can guarantee you it is the cheapest book that will be on any your student syllabus.
And the students will be grateful for that. You can contact Justin on his website, thecryptolegalhandbook.com. If you just scroll to the bottom, you'll find a contact form there. Justin, glad we were finally able to do this. Congratulations on the book launch and wishing you success. Hopefully a podcast like this helps give people some idea of what the book is about. I really enjoyed it. So thank you for all the work that you put into it.
Thanks, Jacob.